Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Be sure to check us out online at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now enjoy this edition of the Midweek Podcast.
Welcome to the Midweek Podcast of Where Did the Road Go? We're back again with Mr. Paul Kimball, and this time we're going to start off at least talking about UFO abductions. How you doing, Paul?
Good, Soraya, although I'm still trying to find out where the road went.
So yeah, I don't know. It just disappeared.
The title of this podcast is very confusing to me because now I feel like I have to be on this search for, you know, the end of the road, and I have no idea where that is. So I don't even know where the not even the end of the road. I don't even know where the road is because it's, you know, it was there, and now where did it go?
Yeah, well, you know, we don't need any roads.
Exactly. All we need – what? Wait. What am I going to do without a road? I won't know where to go unless somebody has pre-planned my destination for me by putting a road there. I'll be lost. Or wait, will I be found? That's kind of deep insight that you're going to get tonight, folks. So buckle up.
Awesome. All right. So we had been talking briefly personally about the role of hypnosis and alien abductions and stuff. You said you've written quite a bit about this, haven't you?
Yeah, over the years, it sort of, I think you raised it to me because a friend of mine, Aaron Gullius, who's an historian and a history professor and wrote the book Extraterrestrials in the American Zeitgeist. Sorry, I like the book. I just couldn't remember the title. I think it's Oh, that's terrible. Aaron, you're going to have to come on Soraya's show and correct me if it's the American,
It sounds right.
It's like Space Aliens and the American Zeitgeist. Just look for Gullius, G-U-L-Y-A-S. Anyway, he has a blog that he writes very infrequently for, or a website, I guess, a blog on his website. And he had penned, it shows how old I am. Nobody pens anything anymore. He had typed, probably using his thumbs on some iPad or whatever, a short column about David Jacobs and the Emma Woods story. And, you know, by implication, the use of hypnosis for memory recovery. So, and he didn't get into it in great detail. He just kind of said, and I'm paraphrasing, and Aaron can correct me, this is crazy. And anybody who ever thought that it was anything other than crazy is crazy. And so that, you know, there was a little tete-a-tete on my Facebook. I reposted it on my Facebook page for The Other Side of Truth. And, you know, some people commented on it. But it's something that I had written about back when I was doing my blog. I don't know, it's probably somewhere between 2005 and 2008 when I was particularly active. Other people have obviously written about it. It's nothing new. But what happened when the whole Emma Woods story, and for folks who don't know, Emma Woods, that's a pseudonym for a woman who lives, I believe she's in her 40s now, lives in New Zealand. So I want folks to, you know, you really need to focus on this. She lives in New Zealand. David Jacobs lives in the United States of America. He's a retired history professor at Temple University, which I believe is in Pennsylvania. It's somewhere in the East anyway. So, you know, they're like literally on two different sides of the world. To make a very long story short, she had been seeing a psychologist, I believe, or a psychiatrist, a therapist of some sort in New Zealand. And eventually she found her way by hook and by crook. You can go online and Google and get the whole story. But she linked up with David Jacobs, who was one of the, I suppose you would call him one of the two or three primary UFO-oriented researchers into the so-called alien abduction phenomenon. The other one would have been the late Bud Hopkins. There's a few others, but Jacobs and Hopkins were certainly the two. They were published. They were on the conference circuit. They've been doing it for 20 years. And John Mack was obviously, from a different perspective, got involved as well, the late John Mack. But Jacobs and Hopkins were the two that took it from this sort of extraterrestrial angle and really ran with it. And both of them relied heavily on the use of hypnosis to recover memory. So Jacob's hypnotized. I mean, as I say it, it just kind of boggles my mind that anybody ever thought that this was, you know, a good idea. But Jacobs hypnotizes Emma Woods by phone, because she lives in New Zealand, of course, and he lives in the United States. As if that's not bad enough. And we can talk about how hypnosis is not just a lousy tool for memory recovery, but a dangerous non-tool. It's not a tool. It's not useful at all for memory recovery. It is useful for certain things. Behavior modification is one of those things. You want to stop smoking. Hypnosis might be able to help some people. In terms of memory recovery, hypnosis is a terrible tool. And you can look at the work of Elizabeth Loftus. In fact, you should look at the work of Elizabeth Loftus, because she's not talking about UFOs or space aliens or anything like that. She's just talking about memory. She's probably the foremost researcher into the subject of human memory, you know, the last 20 or 30 years. And she's looked into all of that, but also, you know, talked about how hypnosis is a terrible tool. And ufology, though, latched onto it, because what hypnosis in a nutshell allows you to do is it allows, without you really sort of realizing it, I guess, but as the hypnotist or the person on the other side of the wall of sleep, if you will, it allows you to basically implant whatever you want. And that sounds, that's not quite what you're doing, but it allows you to steer a person in a direction that has no bearing on reality. So it should come as no surprise that when David Jacobs hypnotizes people, or when Bud Hopkins hypnotized people, they all thought they'd been abducted by space aliens, because Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs believe that space aliens are visiting Earth and abducting people. So, you know, it kind of becomes a merry-go-round of sort of the I'm not even going to call him a therapist, because Bud Hopkins was an artist and David Jacobs right. was a history professor. Neither one of them trained in the least in human psychology or anything like that. So they shouldn't have been anywhere near people who might have had real, and in most cases probably do have, like Emma Woods herself has admitted, real, I don't want to call them problems, real psychological issues, things that should be addressed by a competent, qualified professional. So anyway, all of that is crazy enough, and people had been written, Jacques Vallée and a number of other commentators on the subculture that is ufology, from a historical, from a sociological, from an anthropological perspective, from a cultural perspective, had commented, even from a ufological perspective, even people within ufology who took it seriously, even people who take the extraterrestrial hypothesis seriously, like Kevin Randall, the Roswell researcher. He wrote a book, co-wrote a book called The Abduction Enigma, where he basically said there is no abduction enigma. All of this can be explained. It has nothing to do with space aliens. So even people like Kevin Randall, who is an arch extraterrestrial guy, understood that this was all a house of cards. So that's, there you are. That's what you have. But what David Jacobs did with Emma Woods was take it even further. And she has a website, which I can't remember the URL off the top of my head, but if Soraya, you can look it up and post it hopefully with this interview, and folks can go there, because what she did is she recorded her conversations with Dr. Jacobs. And when I say doctor, he's a professor of history, has a PhD in history. So he's not a medical doctor. He's not a psychiatric, doesn't have a doctorate in psychology. He's a history professor, but I'll give him his honorific, Dr. Jacobs. And when you listen to those recordings, it's kind of, I mean, the boat had sailed on this as being a real research endeavor, but except unless you're crazy. But when you listen to these recordings, you realize that the depths to which David Jacobs had sunk and the damage that he was doing to this woman, and it gets there, you know, I just can't begin. Jeremy Vaney and Jeff Ritzman, two people who I'm not a huge fan of personally. That's just, you know, the way it rolls. But they did a podcast called Paratopia, and you can go, I think it's online. They did very good work they really broke the Emma Woods story, credit where credit is due, and they ran with it. And that's probably the best place to go to get sort of a good picture. I think at one point they even interviewed Emma Woods. And so you had this breaking story a couple of years ago within the subculture that is ufology. And it was fast because what Jacobs did was beyond the pale. He was giving her instructions, you know, to send him her underwear and just, you gotta, folks, you gotta go listen to this stuff. I can't possibly do it justice, but it was beyond the pale of even the craziness of a history professor using hypnosis to recover memories of aliens abducting people on the planet Earth. It went far beyond that. But that, to me, isn't the real story. It's a terrible thing for Emma Woods, because she was used and abused by Dr. Jacobs. It was, if you happen to be a person who really believes that alien abductions are caused by extraterrestrials, it was a terrible thing for you too, because it really kind of put a bullet in the head of that particular meme. I mean, it made anybody who would, how do you defend that? The thing that interests me from a sociological point of view is the response that you saw from ufology, which is this very small subculture of sort of, in quotation marks, researchers and people who are interested, really interested in UFOs. I mean, to a sort of an obsessive way in some cases. And the reaction, by and large, was one of, well, let's give Jacobs a pass. He didn't really do anything wrong. But, you know, we still believe that Bud Hopkins defended Jacobs before Hopkins passed away. And then that led to Hopkins's former wife, documentary filmmaker Carol Rainey, who had co-written a book with him about alien abductions, had been involved in his own research. She came out after this and started criticizing Jacobs, but also criticizing Hopkins and his methodology, and pointing out, you know, piece by piece by piece, how Hopkins wasn't really an honest researcher. And the reaction to that was fascinating too. There were people within the UFO community who implied that, despite the fact that Rainey could document what she was saying and could construct a very plausible narrative, basically brushing it off and saying, well, she's just a jealous ex-wife. And that was coming from men. That was coming, you know, ufology is primarily full of men, not right. Women. There are women who are in ufology, but it's you had to, I don't even know what the percentages are, but I would guess it's 85% guys and 15% women at the sort of levels of the people who really are into it. And so there's always been an undercurrent of misogyny in ufology, sexism. And it really popped out in the whole Emma Woods thing, which became the Emma Woods sort of Carol Rainey thing. And the reactions by a lot of the older men to this story were very telling, and just in their own way, very disturbing. You know, in questions of gender and power and all that sort of stuff, and unequal relationships. Gene Steinberg's a good example. Well, he's a bad example. He's a bad example of a human being, but he's a good example of the kind of reaction you get. It's the reason, folks might know, I used to co-host briefly the Paracast radio show. And one of the reasons, and there were a number of them, but one of the reasons why I finally not just left the co-hosting thing, but I said, I'm not going to moderate your forum anymore. I want nothing more to do with you, is Steinberg's reaction to the Emma Woods story, because it was being talked about on the Paracast forums. And the Paracast, you know, is a significant, at the time it was still a podcast. It had gone from being terrestrial radio to a podcast. Now it's back on internet radio, and I think they might even be on a couple of stations somewhere. I don't know. They're on the same network that carries Alex Jones, which should tell you all you need to know. And Steinberg's reaction was basically, I think this woman's crazy, you know, and we can't, you could say over and over again, Gene, all you have to do is listen to the tapes. And you say, well, the tapes could have been doctored. Well, okay, even if they are doctored, David Jacobs said this. There's no, he isn't denying that he was saying these things, he did these things. And by doctored, edited. Well, yeah, sure, the tapes were edited. But the stuff that you were hearing, they weren't edited in the way that would say, if you had two different phrases, and I said, I like ice cream, and then I said, I hate Hitler, and I went in and edited that so that I wind up saying, I like Hitler. You know, they weren't right. edited in that way. Anybody who is familiar with audio engineering, and I certainly am, would be aware of that. You could listen right. to them and you go, look, there's no obvious markers in here that would show, and that would have been a pretty massive undertaking anyway. I mean, go to the website. There are an awful lot of audio recordings there. So, yeah. But, you know, he sort of closed down debate on the Paracast forums, and he didn't want to talk about it. And the weird thing is he booted Emma Woods off. This is fascinating. Booted Emma Woods because she came in to the Paracast forums and wanted to contribute. And he banned her and kicked her out. This was sort of the final straw for me. And his excuse was because she was operating under a pseudonym. Now, let me tell you something. Anybody who's familiar with any of these forums, Above Top Secret, the Paracast, whatever, you can go down a very long list. The vast majority of people, like 98% of them, operate under a pseudonym. Sharky Boy 24 or Wicker Man 12 or I Live in My Mother's Basement, whatever their name is.
Right.
People like you and I, and to his, I guess, credit, to be fair, Steinberg, we operate above board. I don't hide my identity. I don't post anonymously. You know, there are some people who do that. But by and large, the vast majority of people, they're anonymous. So that's crazy. That's not a reason. The reason was he didn't want to talk about it. And that comes back to, well, who is David Jacobs and who is Bud Hopkins? And what is ufology? And here's where an historian or a sociologist would look at it. And the interrelationships between these people, which are far more fascinating, frankly, than the question of extraterrestrials from Zeta Reticuli. Because what it comes down to is you have this woman in New Zealand, Emma Woods, who is an outsider with no status within the so-called ufological community, who is threatening to undermine sort of a sense of consensus reality within the ufological community, at least about one aspect of it, who is threatening very powerful men within the ufological community. Now, I mean, they're not really powerful in the grand scheme of things, but within this community, you know, right. you have to view every community within as itself. They are powerful men. David Jacobs, Bud Hopkins, they were at the top of the food chain. They had friends who were also at the top of the food chain. Jerry Clark, you can go down a very long list, Stan Friedman, very long list of people who they were friends with, they would go to conferences with. It's all a very incestuous little circle. So if you're a radio host, Gene Steinberg, but Steinberg's not unique. I'm just picking on Gene because he makes it easy. And he's a, in this particular case, he really made it easy because he did literally everything wrong. But if you're a radio host, you have two choices. You can, because you have to take a side. This was not one of those times when you could sort of sit in the middle and go, well, you know, I think both sides maybe have a point. No, listen to the tapes. Both sides don't have a point. David Jacobs abused a relationship of trust, did terrible things. He's a crazy guy. And Emma Woods is a woman with problems, and she admits that. But she went to him looking for help and was meant, you know, psychologically abused. So anyway, there's no middle ground here. And yet, so you have to pick a side. Well, what Steinberg did is what anybody would do, I think, if you have no ethical center and you care about the business of ufology, which is running a radio show or publishing books or whatever it is. You take the side of the people in authority. You don't pick the people at the margins of society. Well, they're all at the margins of society, but even within their margin, the people further marginalized, you conform. You take a conservative position. You basically take the corporatist bottom line, which is to say, I don't care what the truth is. I have financial, business, and interpersonal relationship interests. You know, it's not all business, to protect, and that I value more than getting to the truth of this. So what I'll do is I'll ban Emma Woods, but you know what? I'll have Bud Hopkins or David Jacobs on my radio show. And I'll allow, as Steinberg did, a guy named Sean Mears to continue posting very pro-Bud Hopkins and pro-David Jacobs stuff on his on the Paracast forum. And so here we are in today, and I guess on the Paracast forum, they just had, who did they just have on the Paracast? Jerry Clark, right. And somebody raised the question of the Emma Woods case on the thread on the Paracast forum. I don't participate, but I still check it out from time to time because it amuses me. And it, as an historian or a sociologist, you should check it out because it's a gold mine of material about human behavior. But so here's Steinberg, you know, you keep getting these chances to maybe change. And he says, there will be no further conversation on this on the forums. We will not talk about the Emma Woods case. There's nothing new to talk about, really. And, you know, let's move on. Well, I mean, where do you go from there, Soraya? So you look at this case and you say, what can you extrapolate from it about ufology? And I think this is a valuable lesson for your listeners. And you can't really address it in a half hour, an hour long radio show. But this is the tip of the iceberg. They can go to these things and you know, follow it down the rabbit hole. And what you have to do is you have to divorce the subculture of ufology, which is an interesting thing to study for an historian or a sociologist or a psychiatrist, frankly, from the actual UFO paranormal phenomenon, and understand that what ufology is this group of people, mostly men, mostly older now, who have institutionalized what it and corporatized and codified what is by its very nature a revolutionary subject, which is the idea that we might be dealing with a non-human intelligence, whether it's God or whether it's space aliens or whether it's crypto-terrestrials from under the ocean, whatever it is, extra dimensionals, doesn't matter. We're dealing with something really strange, something weird, something revolutionary. And what they've done is, it's kind of like Jesus. It's a bunch of people sitting around after, you know, Jesus. This is crazy. If people actually start listening to what this Jesus guy said and doing what he said, everything falls apart, right? Well, let's take what he said and let's turn it into a church. Let's turn it into basically a corporation. And that's what they've done in ufology. And so ufology is this corporation. And the UFO phenomenon is something completely different. Never the lesson out of this, and you could draw any one of a number of object lessons, but the David Jacobs alien abduction thing is a perfect example because it involves money, it involves power, it involves gender relations and all that sort of stuff. And look at that and say, that's not something that if you really are interested in the UFO phenomenon, you should have anything to do with. Now, if you're interested in entertainment, and you're interested in studying it as an historian like my friend Aaron Gullius does, or as some of my friends who are sociologists do, or as I do, then ufology is fascinating because it's full of fascinating characters, from Wild Bill Cooper, you know, with his crazy paranoid conspiracy theories, who got killed in a shootout with sheriff's deputies, to people like Marshall Applewhite and Heaven's Gate, all the way on down through to David Jacobs and Gene Steinberg. I mean, it's Jim Moseley with Saucer Smear. That's what he did for 50 years. He looked at, without really saying it, but he was a sociologist studying, without knowing it, studying the UFO subculture. But that has nothing to do with the actual UFO phenomenon. So, long-winded take on all of that. Sorry.
And you see that from the CIA, too, that they study these UFO groups and stuff to help them understand how to spread disinformation and such.
I don't know if I've ever seen any evidence of that, but I'll just accept that that's probably true. Well, I have no doubt.
Valet did a lot of writing about that in one of his books, Messengers of Deception, I think it was.
Right. I have no doubt that the intelligence agencies have been interested for different reasons. I don't think they're interested because they think UFO researchers know the secret contact. You know, they would be interested because here is a group of people at the margins of society that wouldn't pose a threat to American democracy or the empire or whatever. But, you know, that's what the intelligence agencies do. They keep an eye on these groups, particularly in the 50s and 60s, because the message that was coming out in the 50s and 60s from especially the contactee movement was very much one that, if you were to look at it in its core essence, you would say that's communism. Certainly in the 50s, you would have gone, I mean, everything was communism in the 50s.
True.
If you weren't like some right-wing fascist, you were a communist. So, but when the peace, the love, the space brothers, that's communism. You're talking about some sort of utopian fantasy. You must be in league with Joe Stalin and the Red Menace and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, you know, they would have been looking in on stuff like that. I think they would look much less on it over the last couple of decades, because that kind of thing has disappeared. And again, the revolutionary, it's weird. George Adamski and most of the contactees were hoaxers. They were frauds and fakers, and it's a fascinating thing to study. And there may have been some genuine experiences from some of them, but at the upper levels, almost certainly not. And yeah,
they were bad hoaxes at that.
Well, in hindsight, they were bad hoaxes. But at the time, in the context of the 1950s and the early 1960s, you know, things were different then, and people perceived things differently. But still, the message that they were spreading, and one of the reasons why it resonated, the message was one that, you know, sort of touched upon an awful lot of themes throughout American history, cultural history. So if you took the entire UFO thing out of it and just listened to what they would say about things like brotherhood, universal brotherhood, anti-nuclear, a lot of anti-government, but not in a sort of right-wing militia way, but in more of a socialistic kind of way, that would have been very concerning to the United States government at the time, not because of the UFO thing, but because they were a small part of a much broader sort of movement, social movement in the United States, that the authorities found very threatening, especially people like J. Edgar Hoover and Alan Dulles and other people within the intelligence community that, you know, they moved, especially Hoover, moved from administration to administration. Presidents come and go. The civil service is eternal, and the intelligence agencies are even more eternal than the civil service. So, you know, that's the kind of stuff. It does surprise me that more people like Aaron haven't really studied the historical and sociological aspects of the UFO subculture, because there are an awful lot of touchstone points between it and general history of what was going on in the United States, particularly in the United States, where it is primarily rooted, whether in the 50s, you know, peace, love, and understanding, and 60s, or in the 80s and into the 90s, where it took this turn in two ways. One, became very corporatized, much more business oriented, you know, a lot of films, a lot of books, all that sort of stuff really took off in the 80s and 90s. And the conspiracy stuff took off in the 80s or 90s and 90s too. So you can take a look at what was happening in Reagan's America from 1981 until, well, through to Bush. And it hasn't really stopped. It's just continued. So you have this consolidation of, you know, American power, the end of the Cold War. It's a time of, and then 9/11, it's a time of great dislocation into, you know, sort of existential angst about who we are and where we're going. And you see enemies. And the conspiracy subculture linked itself. I mean, it was always there, but it really linked itself in with the sort of UFO subculture and morphed into and the X-Files really touched upon the zeitgeist. I mean, it's chicken and egg. Which came first? The conspiracy UFO merger? Or sort of like a corporate merger, or the X-Files. I don't know, because they both kind of happened at the same time, and then television shows like Dark Skies and things like that. That is all wonderful stuff for an historian or a sociologist to study. It has absolutely nothing to do with sort of the mystery that is the UFO phenomenon.
Right. And when it comes to... Well, getting back to hypnosis for a moment, what do you think about people like John Mack and the way they conducted it?
the criticism that I would level at David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins, I would level at John Mack too. The difference being, the real difference being that John Mack was trained. He was not an artist. He was not a history professor. He was by training a psychiatrist, right?
Right.
A professor at Harvard. So Harvard. So, you know, I think he brought the use of hypnosis, no matter who is doing it, is very problematic when you're using it, trying to use it for memory recovery. Well, it's not just problematic, it's useless. But at least Mack would have followed therapeutic protocols. He is less egregious than people like Jacobs and Hopkins.
Right.
But I don't give Mack a pass, as many of his defenders do, even though I'm more inclined to look at what he wrote and the conclusions that he drew and say, well, I find these more interesting than the space alien thing. But I still don't buy it. I still think that the alien abduction thing, well, it's not aliens. So Mack got away from the alien thing and he said, look, if there is something here, there might be something in terms of a consciousness kind of thing that has nothing to do with space aliens, but might have more to do with us. And he moved off in different directions. And I think, you know, those were much more interesting directions, even though I still think his research in slightly different way was just as flawed as Jacobs or Hopkins because of the methodology that he was using. But he was less egregious. He was certainly less egregious than David Jacobs.
Right. Because
no tapes like the Emma Wood tapes, nothing like that ever happened with John Mack. And some of the stuff that Carol Rainey and others have described about Bud Hopkins's research, none of that kind of stuff ever happened with John Mack either. So, you know, of all the UFO researchers, he wasn't a UFO researcher, of all the people who took the alien abduction phenomenon seriously, Mack was probably, he was certainly the most intelligent of the group. He was certainly the most thoughtful of the group. He was the one who actually came up with some interesting ideas, whether that actually had anything to do with the reality, so-called reality of alien abductions. More likely, he was thinking of these things anyway, and he just kind of put them on top of this alien abduction thing and said, well, I'm just going to take my ideas, as Hopkins and Jacobs did, and put them on top of this and run it through the prism of my own sort of notions. The thing about Mack is his notions were more interesting than, you know, space aliens in 1950s metal flying saucers or whatever, abducting right. people out of their bedrooms to harvest their sperm or whatever it is they were doing. But, you know, if people really want to read good books on the alien abduction phenomenon, here's two that I'll recommend. Susan Clancy, who wrote a book called Abducted. She was also a professor, I believe, at Harvard. I think she was at Harvard, yeah, and a psychologist, and she kind of wrote the standing, as the UFO people would call it, debunking book, as I would call it. Boom, she's hit the nail on the head for most of the cases, generally speaking, things like sleep paralysis and other things like that. The other book that I would recommend, which predates hers, is The Abduction Enigma by Kevin Randall, which will strike people who sort of know the sort of ongoing story recently, you know, my falling out with Kevin Randall over Roswell and stuff. But I still would recommend his book, The Abduction Enigma, which he co-wrote with William Cohn and Russ Estes, because it's a really good deconstruction of the abduction. I called it the abduction cult a few years ago that arose in the 1980s and 1990s, hand in hand with this conspiracy subculture and everything else that sort of took off during the X-Files era. And it's a really good deconstruction of some of the people who were involved, including Mack, Jacobs, Hopkins, somebody like Daryl Sims, I think. So yeah, and you know, it's written in his case from the perspective of a believer, of a guy who actually thinks aliens crashed at Roswell and they're still here, but they're not doing this. So that's interesting too. It's an interesting thought process to watch someone like Kevin Randall, who is very skeptical about alien abductions and cattle mutilations. He's you know, written, he talked, I had him in one of my films, Fields of Fear, where he says there's nothing to cattle mutilations. It can all, and I agree with him, it can all be explained, and here's how. And yet, he still thinks that space aliens in metal spaceships from Zeta Reticuli or wherever crash landed in the desert outside Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. And we recovered it and have a massive conspiracy. So he's, you know, you probably do a movie about Kevin because it's really cool. It's not cool, but it's really fascinating to stand back and see somebody who can be so logical and thoughtful in many areas dealing with sort of this phenomenon, and yet on one thing he has this massive blind spot, which is Roswell. That's his kryptonite is Roswell. He can't see reason when it comes to Roswell. So, you know, that's another interesting thing. But I would recommend his book on the alien abduction thing, The Abduction Enigma. It's a really good book.
Okay. What about the people who spontaneously recall this stuff that don't need hypnosis, that are somewhat similar, you know, where they see a light, they pull over to the side of the road, and they have a what seems to be an alien abduction experience? Where does that fall into this?
I thought you were going to say, what about the people who spontaneously combust?
It's going to
go, well, there's a left turn in the middle of it. I don't know anything about spontaneous combustion.
All right.
I'm not familiar or aware of anybody that could credibly make that claim that has supporting evidence of any sort, witnesses, anything like that, that could back them up. And I have to say, I'm very familiar with the alien abduction phenomenon as it relates to the use of hypnosis, as it relates to the UFO subcultures, that kind of stuff. I certainly, you know, I'm not going to put myself forward as somebody who has studied each and every claim in excruciating detail, because I don't think I have to. I think I can look at the broad picture and say there's nothing here. This can be explained. But if there are cases that I'm not aware of or that I just haven't seen of what you're talking about, I'd be interested to look at them. I would refer, you know, I'd probably send an email to Susan Clancy. Or, well, I wouldn't send one to Kevin Randall. And that's never going to happen again. But, you know, I would, you know, I have friends who are psychiatrists, and I would refer that question to them, because I'm certain there's an explanation for it. And yeah, so that's what I would do. That's going to seem like a wishy-washy answer, but my dad always told me, if you don't have an answer, don't pretend that you do. So okay. I'm not going to brass my way through that. I'm just not familiar with those particular cases. I've never heard of any. The abduction researchers will sometimes trot out, you know, there are other cases of people who are perfectly awake driving down the road and they get abducted. It doesn't always happen in your bedroom, blah, blah, blah. But those aren't the cases they talk about. They'll say that those cases exist, but those aren't the ones that they write about in their books. Those aren't the ones they talk about when they go to conferences. You know, when they go to conferences or write their books or whatever, they, generally speaking, we're talking about people, the claims that are coming out, their memories were recovered through hypnosis. You know, those are the poster child cases. And I would expect, having done a number of conferences about a number of things, that, or write a book or whatever, or make a film, you put your best evidence forward. You don't take the bad cases and say, oh, I'm going to talk about those today. I've got better ones, but I'm not going to tell you about those ones. I'm going to write this book about a mediocre case. Well, no. So the ones that they talk about are cases, you know, like the so-called Linda Cortil case, which is Bud Hopkins's big super claim to fame. And again, you know, the story of a woman who was abducted while at home in her bedroom, floated out through the window of her house or whatever. And the UN Secretary General, Perez de Cuellar, apparently saw this happen over New York. So, you know.
Wasn't this thoroughly debunked as well?
Oh, of course. And this is one of the things that Carol Rainey was talking about. You'd have to be really obtuse, or like Kevin in the Roswell, he doesn't have a blind spot here, but like Kevin with Roswell, you would have to have some kind of massive blind spot. What Carl Flock, the late Carl Flock, friend of mine, who was a researcher interested in UFOs, he was a lot of other things too, including a former CIA agent, he called it the will to believe. And in respect of Roswell, his book was subtitled, it was Roswell, you know, subtitle, Inconvenient Facts and the Will to Believe. And this idea that you have the will to believe. I believe that people are being abducted by space aliens. Well, here's some inconvenient facts for you. You know, boom, 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 all down the road. And, well, what do? That's an interesting thing for historians and sociologists and psychiatrists to study. When these two things meet each other, they're like Mars and Venus colliding. Strange things happen. And the will to believe will almost always trump the inconvenient facts. So you get people tying themselves into pretzels. Here's logical pretzels. Here's a perfect example. Majestic 12. Stan Friedman. Stan's my uncle. I've known him for 30 years. He's a very intelligent man. He's a good person, too. And yet, on Majestic 12, that's his, Roswell's his blind spot, but Majestic 12 is, it's not just his blind spot, it's his deaf, dumb, and blind spot. You know, no sensible person would look at the Majestic 12 stuff and say, if you really looked at it, would say, this is real, that this is anything other than a fraud. And you can list 20 inconvenient facts. I once sent Stan a letter, and it was a public sort of correspondence between us, where I just listed four. And, you know, I'm not going to go into all of them, but four, just answer me these four questions, Stan. And he couldn't, but his answer always comes back to, well, it has to be real because it confirms my belief in the Roswell incident and the narrative that I believe in the Roswell incident. And so there you have inconvenient facts running headlong into the will to believe. And it's sort of fascinating to watch, because the will to believe will almost always win. I'm trying very hard to think of somebody within the UFO subculture whose will to believe has actually been sort of, not undermined, but let's say, I was going to say brushed away, but overcome. There you go. Overcome by inconvenient facts. And off the top of my head, I can't really think of anyone. You know, when you have somebody who has such a strong will to believe, who is so invested in a particular case or a particular idea or a particular story, it's virtually unshakable. It's kind of like having a religious faith. And no matter how much logic you throw at that person, you really can't shake them. Scott Ramsey, who is an intelligent man on the so-called Aztec UFO crash that I did a film about, I think, almost 10 years ago now. He's another example. Nobody in their right mind believes that a space alien UFO crash, spaceship crashed in Aztec. When you look at the case in 1948, when you look at the case, it all goes back to two con men named Silas Newton and Leo Gebauer, and then a very credulous journalist, and I use journalist in quotation marks, Frank Scully, who wrote a book about it. And that's it. And yet Scott has now written 60 years plus, right? Yeah, more than 60 years later, written a book about it. UFO crash at Aztec. I called it Ufology's Dracula once. You know, people keep coming along and putting the stake in it. Here are the inconvenient facts, stake. And then somebody wanders along about 10 years later, doesn't really look into the inconvenient facts or has a will to believe. And they go, huh, wonder why this guy's lying in the coffin with a stake in his chest. Well, I'll just pull it out and see what happens. And, you know, villagers get raped and pillaged and plundered and people get eaten and stuff. And eventually somebody stakes him again. And 10 years later, somebody wanders by again. This is not a phenomenon that is unique to ufology. This happens in almost every aspect of our lives. But, you know, so you could study it in Holocaust denial. There's another good example. You know, you could look at Holocaust denial and you will find people who you can throw every single fact. You could say, look, here's the testimony of Rudolf Hess, the commandant at Auschwitz. He's the guy who ran Auschwitz before they hanged him for war crimes. Here's his account. Testified at the Nuremberg trials. He admitted it. What more do you need? I mean, and you could give tons more. Here's the documents, here's this, here's that. But that alone, not to mention the fact that millions of Jews sort of disappeared.
Right.
And yet, if you're a Holocaust denier, you know, there's a very good film by the great documentary maker, Errol Morris, about Fred Leuchter, who is one of the preeminent Holocaust deniers in the United States. called Mr. Death, because he was involved in executing people. He made machines that the United States, various states, used to execute people. So Leuchter, this whole film is about Leuchter, and again, it's a film about the will to believe meeting inconvenient facts, and the will to believe triumphs. So you can find it. You can listen to political discourses in the United States too. Listen to someone like Michelle Bachmann talk, or Ted Cruz, or, you know, you can find them on the left, what you folks call the left, what the rest of the world calls the right. You know, it's not really the left, but, you know, you can find people like that in the Democratic Party too, who, you know, their will to believe will just triumph over everything. And the inconvenient facts be damned. So, but that's fascinating. It's a window into human behavior and the way that we think and process information and the way that we believe in things. And so the study of ufology, looking into it from that perspective, whether it's the David Jacobs story and seeing how someone like Gene Steinberg responds, or someone like Jerry Clark responded, or whether it's Majestic 12 and seeing how someone like Stan Friedman continues to believe despite the inconvenient facts, or Kevin Randall with Roswell, they're not alone. I mean, we all have something like that in our lives. In my case, girlfriends, probably. But, you know, I believe she still loves me. I just believe. I mean, we all have blind spots. And so studying that kind of stuff is a very useful thing. But it doesn't have anything to do with the mystery that is the UFO phenomenon or anything like that. So they're two separate things. And I'm interested in both. I'm interested in the mystery because it's a mystery. I find it's fascinating to me. And the possibilities are endless. And really, as we talked about when I was on your radio show once, the idea that we may very, talking about my book, we may very well be dealing with some form of advanced non-human intelligence. What does that mean for us? All this sort of stuff.
Right.
That's really revolutionary stuff. It is, to use an overused word, paradigm altering when you think of the implications. And religion should be like that too. And yet, what things like ufology do is they take all the revolution out of it and they turn it into, you know, a circuit of chummy guys, usually in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, with expanding waistlines and thinning hairlines, hanging out at conferences, reinforcing each other's belief systems over a couple of beers. And I mean, it does a disservice to whatever the phenomenon might actually be, if there is something truly anomalous and wondrous to the phenomenon. So the biggest crime that ufology has ever committed is a singular lack of imagination, because they've taken something that should be really fun and gee whiz and you know, open the doors to all sorts of possibilities, throw out everything, you know, like my friend the late Mac Tonies did with his crypto-terrestrial hypothesis, which was a lot of people within ufology roundly criticized, the old guard. This can't make it, it doesn't make any sense. Dudes, it's a thought experiment. Lighten up. He's just bandying some ideas about, because none of us know what the answer is. So, but you have your theory, right? You have your thing. You want to believe it's space aliens. So anything that it's like the Catholic Church in the Inquisition. Anything that actually goes against what the Pope says, we're going to burn you at the stake. Well, that's not fun. That's not revolutionary. And so no wonder that young people want nothing to do with it. That when you go to these conferences, the people that you see have been going to these conferences for 30 and 40 years.
And even Whitley Strieber, when he started out and he started saying this, I don't believe this is necessarily extraterrestrials, he got blackballed by a lot of these people.
Yeah, Strieber's an interesting cat. You know, I've never talked to him. I'd like to. I don't believe a thing he says. I don't disbelieve everything he says either. I think he's a guy who is, he's one of two things. He's a guy who had some weird experiences. Well, he's one of three things. A guy who had some weird experiences and has done his best, not always successfully, to process those experiences. That's one option. He's a guy who has real psychological problems masquerading as real experiences, and he's done his best to try and come to grips with that. That's another option. And the third option is he's a liar, a fraud, a huckster, and he's just, you know, he's writing fiction masquerading as nonfiction. That's an option. I don't know which one of those options is true. I don't know if Whitley Strieber knows which one of those. And there is a possibility that all three of those options could be true.
Sure.
That somebody could have had a real experience. I'm not going to talk about Strieber. Somebody could have had a real experience They could also have what we might call psychological problems. And it, you know, it's interesting to try and, you know, figure out what psychological problems are, because you can go back in the 19th century and things that we consider perfectly, relatively perfectly normal now, were considered psychological aberrations, could get you locked up in the loony bin in the 19th century, even in the 20th century, a number of them having to do with sexual things.
Right.
So, you know, those kinds, our understanding and our opinion of what is right and what is wrong changes over time. You know, and the third option could be true too. You could have those two things and then try and cash in, make some money off it too. And maybe, you know, some of the story is true and some of the story isn't true. I'll give you a good example, which I'll cop to, no pun intended, although you'll see what I mean in a second. When I was a law student, I served with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police one summer as a special constable. I would stay, unlike some law students, every year they would send them out and do that. So I was, most of the people they would send would get sent to urban or at least town detachments and, you know, do some ride-alongs and shuffle paperwork, basically. I was sent to the wilds of northern Cape Breton. Go find a map, folks, and take a look, to the Inganish Beach Detachment, which in the summer, because it's a tourist destination, the population kind of quadruples on the eastern side of the Cape Breton Island, part of Nova Scotia. And it's a detachment where at the bottom, you know, where it starts in the south, you either drive around a cove or you take a ferry to get there. And basically, you go over one mountain and the detachment runs until you hit another mountain. It's the Cape Breton Highlands. So it's a wild and woolly, full of lots of coves and smugglers and crazy stuff. And as soon as I got there, the commanding corporal said, because my uniform is the same as theirs, with two exceptions. Mounties have a yellow stripe around their hat. I had a blue stripe, and I had student patches under my Mountie insignia on my uniform. They took the student patches off, and they gave me one of their hats with a yellow stripe. And they said, if anyone asks why you're not wearing a gun, just tell them you're fresh out of the academy, because you're a summer replacement. Because of budget cuts, every year they would get, before that, they'd gotten an extra Mountie to augment the detachment. But because of, so they explained it to me at least, because of budget cuts that year, I was the replacement. They were none too happy about that either. So on my second day there, they had me out learning how to use the shotgun that we carried in the car, and on and on and on. Fine. So I had a lot of really cool experiences. Real stuff actually happened to me. But because I'm a storyteller, of the stories that I will tell when I get in a bar, and I've had a few, and I'll tell them about my RCMP experience, let me say that 70% are completely true. Another 15% are sort of true, but maybe I'm embellishing. And 15% are completely false. I just made that one up. But it's a cool story. So, well, what does that make me? Well, it makes me a liar for that 15%, although I would prefer the term bard. You know, for the 15% that I'm embellishing, it makes me sort of a liar, but there's a kernel of truth there. And for the 70, let's say more like 60%, 60 to 70% that really did happen, and I'm telling pretty much as best I can, and now we're back to memory, because that was 20 years ago. So right. My memory, you know, even in that 60 to 70% that I'm recounting as accurately as I can remember, I believe it to be true. I believe that that's what actually happened. If you went and talked to the other people who might have been there for those particular incidents, their story might seem a little different than mine. The general details, you know, the big picture would probably be the same, but we would remember things differently. Passage of time, different people observe different things in different ways. So that's an interesting sort of sidetrack too. But, you know, getting back to Strieber or anybody like that, maybe Whitley Strieber is like me. 60 to 70% of it really happened, at least as he remembered it. He's embellished it a bit. So that's 15%. And maybe he made 15% of the stuff up. And maybe the percentages are different. That doesn't make... And I don't even know if that's true. Maybe he made it all up. Maybe he didn't make any of it up. But these kinds of stories, the stories that we all tell, I think are like that. I don't think anybody ever completely tells the full truth. We all embellish to some degree or another to make ourselves look better or to make ourselves look more interesting. Let me tell you, the percentages change, by the way, if I'm telling those stories to an attractive woman, you know, and I want to seem like the cool, rebellious guy who used to be a cop. And so here's some cool stories. Well, maybe then only 50% of it is true. I don't know, whatever. So for all sorts of different reasons, we tell stories that are part true and maybe embellished, so in some sense not true. We remember things differently. And weirdly enough, we remember strange things. There are parts, like I could go back 35 years to when I was 11 or 12. I obviously can't remember everything that happened to me when I was 10 or 11 or 12. But I can, there are, for whatever reason, and I have no idea, there would be specific instances that I can remember.
Absolutely.
And they're not extraordinary. It's not like I can't remember anything about being 11 except for the one time that I was abducted by space aliens or neo-Nazis. I remember that. No, you know what? I've probably forgotten that one or blocked it out. But I'll remember a fight I had with my mom. I do. Mm-hmm. I actually remember one when I think I was about 15 or 16, this big blowout fight with my mom. I mean, I had lots of fights with my mom, and I had far more good times with my mom. But that one I remember. I have no idea why. Because, you know, within half an hour of it happening, we were having dinner together. So it wasn't a big thing, but that one sticks in my mind. And so, you know, memory is a tricky thing. And all of this stuff, and this sort of, hopefully people are still listening, and I'm sorry I rattled on, but everybody has to understand that when you're dealing with eyewitness testimony too, people can be very honest in what they think they saw. And this relates to the UFO thing. But did they actually see it? Even if they did see it, are they remembering it? You know, memory is not a photograph. It's not like you're not a camera where you just click and go, boom, it is frozen in time. I have an exact picture of what happened. And then 6 months later, I can just pull that picture out and tell, and there it is. It's like that happened. It doesn't work that way. It's why as police officers, when you would be on scene, you always carried a notebook. You would take notes.
Yeah.
Because 6 months later, you would be called in to testify. And the phrase that I got quite used to, even after my term ended and I went back to law school, I kept going back up. People in law school were going, where are you going this week, Paul? I'm going, I'm going to miss civil procedure class. I got to go this 5-hour drive to the mountains of Cape Breton to testify against, you know, some guy who stole a car or whatever. And, you know, Your Honor, somebody would ask a question and you just go, Your Honor, I'd like permission to refresh my memory by referring to my notes. And then the following question your lawyer would ask you or the judge would ask you, are those notes that you made at the time? Yes, Your Honor, they are. Okay, then you can look at your notes. And I'd pull, and because I couldn't remember. What color was the car? I don't know. Blue? I guess it was blue because I wrote it down it was blue, but I don't remember it was blue now. So that when skeptics or debunkers, as the UFO people call them, criticize eyewitness testimony and memory, they're absolutely right. But that doesn't mean it's completely useless. You can still discern out of that. There are things that you can pull out of that, but it's nothing you can ever take to the bank and say, boom, this is absolutely true because it's a photograph. You know what's a photograph? A photograph. That's well, what a photo.
Not only that, but your senses can deceive you as well.
Absolutely.
Every time I've ever had a paranormal experience, the first thing I do is note down every little thing I can think of and try to test my senses on it. And so I've gone back to things that have happened to me 10, 15 years ago, and I think, oh, this is what happened, and I read it and go, well, it's close to what happened, but that's not what I wrote down.
Yeah, it would be interesting if we went through, you raise a good point, say somebody every single day of their life, and let's just assume they did it when it happened, within a period of 10 minutes of something happening. They wrote down everything that ever happened to them. And even that's going to be a little flawed because there's still questions of perception. You know, maybe you focused in on one thing and something else was going on over in the side. But let's assume that it was as accurate. It was 95% accurate, that they could capture 90 to 95% of what had happened to them and write it down. Go talk to them 10 years later and ask them to recount, without referring to their notes, to recount what had happened to them and see how much of that matched what the 90%, 95% they got, you know, let's say accurate at the time. I'm willing to bet maybe it's 70 or 60% now. Talk to them 20 years later. You know, as time passes, that percentage of accuracy is going to get less and lower and lower.
Yep.
And I, this can be for things, I'm not talking about, you know, the girl you kissed at the high school dance that maybe you kissed four girls that night, so it wasn't terribly important. I'm not saying I ever did that, but the, let's like a car accident where your cousin died or something like that. It should be a terribly traumatic thing that you really, it never leaves you. Like Roswell, for instance. So, you know, like Jesse Marcel and Jesse Marcel Jr. I guarantee you that 20 or 30 years later, your memories of that incident, no matter how traumatic, no matter how special, it could be the first time you ever had sex, whatever, will not match the notes that you would have taken at that particular time. So then that leads us back, say, to Roswell, where you have people like Jesse Marcel, who were asked to, and his son, Jesse Marcel Jr., who were asked to recount what had happened to them 30 plus years earlier by researchers who wandered in, and like Stan Friedman and then eventually Kevin Randall and others, who were talking to them 30 to 40 years later. And now you have new, in quotation marks, new witnesses being dredged up. I mean, it's the dregs of the barrel. 66 years now later. So you're asking people in probably their 80s or 90s to remember something that happened 60 plus years ago. And when they tell you, and you're asking them leading questions, which is what they do, and when they tell you something, the problem with the UFO researchers in the Roswell case, for instance, is they treat that like it's a photograph. It's not a photograph. It's a fog bank, you know, and you're driving through St. John, New Brunswick or Bangor, Maine or whatever, and you're in a fog bank. And I did that. St. John is a major city in southern New Brunswick. And I remember it was when we were coming back from shooting an episode of Ghost Cases in St. Andrews, which is a town on the border between New Brunswick and Maine. I was halfway, the highway kind of runs through St. John, and you never have to get off. You can literally drive through the middle of St. John on the highway, and it's like Los Angeles, only, you know, 1/100th the size. Off ramps and everything, but you don't have to get off the highway. You could just keep going. I was halfway in the middle of the city before I realized that Holly, my co-host, and I were in the middle of the city. The fog was so thick that you didn't see any of the city. I knew there was a highway. I could see that. And eventually, you know, a building or two popped up. It's like, oh my God, we're out of gas. This is where I get off. Well, that's what memory is like 30 or 40 or 50 or 60,
oh, sure.
60 years later. But the people, the UFO believers, remember, inconvenient facts and the will to believe? Well, there's an inconvenient fact. We don't understand really how memory works. And even the bits that we do understand, the one thing we do understand is it's not a photograph. And it will, you know, it changes over a period of time. That's an inconvenient fact that people who want to believe that a spacecraft crashed in Roswell will completely ignore when they look at eyewitness accounts of what people claim to have experienced or saw or whatever. So, you know, that's the ultimate inconvenient fact.
And that's why I'm so glad I wrote this stuff down in such detail, because most of my memory seems to be 80 to 90% correct, but there'll be little details that are switched. Like I might think person A did this when it was really person B, and it's like, oh, huh, I could have sworn it was person A. And in my head, it still doesn't feel right to look at that information and see that I was wrong. I was the other person that did that.
Yeah, and those are the kind of details that can make a real difference.
Absolutely.
I can look at the Ghost Cases stuff that we did, for instance, in 2009. So what? I'm 4 years, 4 years and a few months. Well, 5 years from when we started. Actually, I started shooting that in 2008. So October of 2008. So 5 years later, you know, between 4 and 5 years. I have the ability to go look at the footage that was taken and the episodes of, and we didn't use the dull footage. So the things that I would look back on and say, that was really weird. That happened to me. This happened, blah, blah, blah. I didn't write it down. I have footage. So yeah. I actually have a photo. Now I don't have a photo of a ghost. I have video footage though of Holly and I reacting to whatever it was that might've been happening. And there's a case you know, I call it the case of the baby in the basement, which I think maybe you and I talked about once.
I think so.
Where I'm sitting in the basement of this farmhouse and, you know, by myself, and the door behind me blows open, that kind of thing. I ran a little experiment with myself not too long ago where I thought, well, okay, I'm going to write down what I think happened, because I hadn't watched the episode in almost 2 years, even though it's online. You can go to my website and see it. Here's what I think happened. Here's how I remember it. I was down for about this long. I said this, blah, 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 blah. Now, I have a 100% accurate record of what actually happened. It's not, I didn't write a note down and got 90% of it. I have a video camera trained on me for the entire time. Boom. And I have that footage. If I had to put a percentage, even 4 years later, of what I can actually, from memory, recall, it's, you know, around 85 to 90%. I got things wrong. There were certain things about that that I didn't remember. Now, were they big things or major things? No, maybe not. And I got the central story right. The takeaway hasn't changed.
Right.
Door comes open, blah, blah, blah. There's no wind. I go out and I investigate, yada, yada, yada. Call me in 20 years and see what that percentage is going to be. Probably a lot lower. And so, but I'll still tell a full 100% story, but it'll probably have new details. I might mix the parts of that episode up with another episode that we did.
Sure.
And then so this is how legends and myths and, you know, when all humans had were really oral histories where people would tell stories, bards, again, you know, you can't rely on it's like King Arthur or Robin Hood. Was there a real King Arthur? Probably somebody like that. Was there a real Robin Hood? Probably a character or series of characters that eventually, because the stories were told, got merged into that one character. Sure. We do the same thing. Studs Terkel, a great historian in the 20th century, great oral historian. They taught us this when I was in grad school, oral research methodology. There's a way to ask questions. When you're an historian, and there are different types of questions in many cases than say a lawyer would ask, but the gist of it is the same. It's a skill. You have to be trained to do it. You can't just, it's funny. And this gets into the, you know, like look at Stan Friedman. I don't want to pick on Stan, but Stan, all his books say nuclear physicist. Well, it's true. He is a nuclear physicist. So what? Because most of his books have nothing to do with nuclear physics.
Right.
What they have to do with is a guy who went out, and by and large, most of the research that he did was oral research history. It was like an oral historian going out and interviewing people. Hey, you were at D-Day. How do you remember that? And, you know, you could interview 10 different guys on Omaha Beach and get 10 different stories out of which you could pull an overall narrative that was probably pretty accurate.
Right.
Even though the individual stories vary. But that would, a trained historian could do that. But somebody who wanders in, who has a pre-existing belief system, as Stan did, as Kevin Randall did, as all these people did, wanting to believe in alien spacecraft, well, the questions, and having no training in how you're going to ask questions, how you structure an interview, what you can and can't do, what you shouldn't do, how you don't lead witnesses, all that stuff. They did all of that. They did all the wrong stuff. And so, how much of that narrative, even from the very beginning, was fed to the witnesses by the researchers? You know, I think a not insignificant part of it. So that's kind of like David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins when they're doing their abduction research. This is me coming back. So this is me. We were on a road and we got off the road. This is me getting us back on the road as we head towards the end, because it's probably the seventh inning in the baseball game. But, you know, that's... same thing with David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins. They have a narrative that they already believe in. It's a chicken and egg thing, and I know the chicken came first. And the chicken is space aliens. Okay, well, then we need to get the egg. You know, the egg has to be space aliens. So unfortunately, Emma Woods or whomever, you're the egg. That doesn't make any sense. But hopefully folks know what I'm talking about. So, you know, they project onto these people their own belief system. Now, that's not particularly dangerous if you're Jesse Marcel, because you might, or Walter Haught, you might be asked leading questions, and maybe you tell a story, but it's not going to be dangerous to your psychological health. But if you're Emma Woods, and it's David Jacobs putting you under hypnosis, by phone, folks, and implanting ideas in you and taking what is a pre-existing psychological problem and making it far, far worse for his own interests, then that is a real problem. That's not a that's not a problem for ufology. Well, it is. But that's a problem for anybody who doesn't want to see innocent people abused and taken advantage of. And it's a black eye. Anybody standing outside ufology would look at this and say it is, that is obviously bad. But what might be arguably worse was the reaction from the majority, not everyone, but the majority of people within ufology, within that subculture, when confronted with the inconvenient fact that was what David Jacobs did to Emma Woods, they chose the will to believe. And it and they made the wrong choice. But that's what happens. That's now, where it leads us.
Now, someone who might want to try to defend hypnosis would point out that they do use it occasionally in the court of law as acceptable evidence.
No, they don't.
They don't?
No, absolutely not. Hypnotically recovered, so-called hypnotically recovered testimony is to be used. In fact, when I wrote a blog post, I actually, about this a few years ago, I went to the Crown Prosecution Service. I mean, I could have picked anything, but I went to the United Kingdom's Crown Prosecution Service, which is like the Attorney General in the U.S. or your district attorneys. And they specifically stated, I posted it. I said, here's the guidelines they use. Hypnotically recovered testimony is not admissible in a court of law. Doesn't mean it's completely useless. Maybe we can learn something from it. You never know. But it is not admissible for the truth of the statement in a court of law because, and then there was a long, there's a lot of reasons, but you can look at the, there's a number of cases where hypnotically, and it had nothing to do with UFOs, primarily child abuse cases, alleged child abuse cases.
Yeah.
A couple of real scandals. One, I think in Canada, in Saskatchewan, was it Martinville 20 years ago, I think. I'd have to look that up, but there's a famous one in Canada anyway, and there are ones in the United States too, where, you know, it's like the Salem witch trials. And hypnotically sort of induced belief in child abuse is people are being convicted who were not guilty, but they were being, hypnosis was being used and it was being accepted in many cases, even though it shouldn't have been legally, for the truth of the statements. And the damage that was done to people's lives through that was tremendous. And that all fell apart. You know, again, check the work of Elizabeth Loftus, because I think she talks about some of these things and other researchers like her. All of that fell apart, I think. You know, I might have my dates wrong, in the 1980s and 1990s, because I remember it, and here you go, folks, memory. But I remember it from when I was in my 20s and early 30s that this was a going concern. So,
well, it also built into the satanic abuse type of thing going on, too, where they kept recovering false memories of satanic abuse.
Yeah. You could not walk into a court of law and use hypnotically recovered testimony to prove the truth of the statement that was elicited from that hypnotic testimony. Hmm. So, for instance, you've got somebody who says, Linda Cortile, under hypnosis, I was abducted by space aliens. Oh, well, that's proof, right? That's absolute proof. No, it's not. No court of law in the United States or Canada or the United Kingdom or any other country that I know of would allow you to walk in and say, we can prove this. Well, how are you going to prove it? Well, we hypnotized her. And she told us under hypnosis that that's what happened to her. Pardon? No, sorry, that's not going to happen. So, yeah.
All right, fair enough. All right, well, I guess we're...
And if I'm wrong on that, if there is a jurisdiction that does allow that, somebody send me an email or post a comment on this episode and point out where I'm wrong. I don't mind being shown... Well, I do mind, but after I get over my ego, you know, my ego hurt or whatever, I go, oh, well, okay, good, I learned something. If there is a jurisdiction that does allow that, I'd be interested to hear where that jurisdiction is. And if somebody could cite me a case, that'd be fascinating.
I thought I had heard it had been used to recover, like, license plate numbers that people had seen that they couldn't remember consciously and stuff like that.
I don't think so. But again, I'm happy. Right. I'm happy, or at least I'm not unhappy, to be proven wrong if that's the case.
I could have been remembering wrong, or I could have been told wrong.
See, there you go. there we are. We're back to the problems with memory.
Absolutely.
And the potential problems with, you know, it's like the old shampoo, not a shampoo commercial, but the old thing. Like if you have a circle of kids, 10 kids, and I whisper in your ear something, by the time it gets to the 10th kid, it will have changed. And that's always fun. I remember doing that as a kid. It was fun. Some of the kids in that chain would do it on purpose. They'd do it just to screw with people. So, and other people would do it just because maybe they didn't hear it right or whatever. But by the time it gets back to the person who started it, the story is going to be different.
Or they reinterpreted it with their own filters.
Absolutely. So if it was just a statement like, Bob has a dog, that would probably come back the way it was meant to. Although some smart ass might say, Bob has a hamster or a crocodile. But, you know, let's assume that maybe Bob has a dog makes it through because it's just one sentence. But if it was actually a story about Bob having a dog and then Bob and the dog get lost and other things like that, you had to tell a 1-minute story. That story is going to be significantly different when it gets relayed back to me 10 kids later. So, you know, that has a lot to do with how stories are told, how people hear things, how people observe things, all of that. And that is something that ufology, by and large, just completely ignores. And, you know, that's an interesting thing for sociologists to study, because we do it, as I said earlier, we all do it in our everyday lives, politics, the news, whatever we watch. We tend to ignore things that, you know, might not fit with our preconceived notions.
And every one of us does that.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of us, ufologists, just happen to do it more, you know, more than, say, the average person. So they skew the average up, if you will.
All right. And we've been talking with Mr. Paul Kimball. And where can people find you online?
That's Dr. Paul Kimball, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, Dr. I'm just Paul Kimball. I could. I have a Juris Doctorate, a JD, my law degree. In Europe, they don't do this in the United States, but in Europe, they actually call lawyers doctor. Because you have doctoral, you know, instead of an MD, you have a JD. So I've actually kind of been toying with the idea that I want to be referred to now within ufology as Dr. Paul Kimball. Because if Dr. David Jacobs with his PhD in history can be referred to as a doctor,
right.
I want to be a doctor too. I'm just joking. Where can people find me?
Yes.
The Victory Arms, which is the bar at the Lord Nelson Hotel here in Halifax. I'll probably be there tomorrow night with an actress telling my RCMP stories. But otherwise, my website is www.beyonderstv.com. That's my personal website, BEYONDERSTV.com.
And are you working on any movies or anything currently?
Yeah, actually, I'm just finishing up a film called Damnation, I've said that on every interview I've done for the last 6 months, but we're shooting one or two new scenes in 2 weeks, and then it'll be about 2 or 3 weeks after that, the film, it's a feature film, will be done by the end of November, or else my distributor in the United Kingdom will probably shoot me. And then we start shooting a much bigger feature film, because that was a relatively low-budget indie. We start shooting another science fiction film in early January that I wrote the script for and that I'll be directing.
What's that one called?
It's called Roundabout. And so if you want to follow Damnation, it's www.damnationthemovie.com. And Roundabout, and there's only a one-page website, you know, it hasn't really been built yet. It's www.ledacalder.com, and that's the name of the lead character.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
All right. And Damnation, a horror movie?
I guess. You know, it's three people in a house in the woods, and one of them might be the devil. So, yeah, okay. I'd call it more of a psychological thriller.
Gotcha.
With maybe some horror elements. Yeah.
Nice. So, wait, is this like M. Night Shyamalan's Devil?
No, although I actually... if you read my book, you know my opinions of M. Night Shyamalan.
Which is why I brought it up.
Yeah, he made one good movie and then a bunch of crappy ones. Well, he made 1.5 good movies. Unbreakable was a good movie until he screwed up the ending. But I actually liked Devil for what it was. It wasn't a great film, but it didn't offend me. And then I realized he didn't actually direct it. He just produced it. So, fair enough.
All right. Well, on that note... Thanks for talking tonight, Paul. We'll have you back in a month or so, and we'll cover something else.
Sure. Yeah, that sounds like fun. I always enjoy talking to you, Soraya, and I always enjoy listening to your show, too, even when I'm not on it. So.
Well, thank you.
Actually, I don't listen to it when I'm on it, so because I already heard what I said.
So you are a musician, but you had something else you wanted us to end the show with tonight, rather than something of yours.
Yeah, I don't want to plug my own stuff because I've been retired for 20 years. So I have a friend, a young guy named Dan Jardine, who actually worked on one of my films once. He's a musician in Toronto, fronts a number of bands. He's in a number of bands, but he's in one that I like them all, but he's in one called Danger Dean, and they have a new, we used to call it an EP when I was a kid, but I guess a new album or whatever out. And the first single is a song called Undertow, which I really like. So Dan's a really good guy. He looks like Steve McQueen, which I think is really cool. So it's it's Dan Jardine, Danger Dean, who looks like Steve McQueen, and the song is called Undertow. If you could play that, that'd be great.
All right, here we go.
It was dark, there was a storm and its waves came crashing 30 feet high upon the shores. And all that I could do was smile, cause I knew that the ocean could wash away any damage that I could do to you. Babe, swim away, swim away. It was warm.